Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 295 for Friday, March 28th, 2014. I am recording this episode Tuesday night, March 25th in Denver, because tomorrow Darlene and I are going to fly to Boston for a week-long visit with family and a quick jaunt to Maine, I think, which is always beautiful in the off-season. My guest this week is also in motion, having kicked off a 20-city book tour last week in Brookline, Massachusetts. I caught up with Austin Kleon yesterday at his home in Austin, Texas, by Skype. He was making a pit stop there en route next week to Florida, Georgia, and California. At each stop and here at the Kindle Chronicles, he is spreading the word about his latest book, which tells you how anyone can share his or her creativity or art and get discovered.
One of the things I always tell people is like, well, you know, you're not guaranteed a living from this. I think what you're guaranteed is a life. You know, you can set up a life through this way of operating. But I do think that, you know, if you operate this way, you know, you have a better shot at a living.
In news, there's really just one big story this week, namely the arrival of real spendable book credits thanks to the settlement of the Department of Justice antitrust case against four big publishers. For the tech tip, I'm going to revisit a handy tool named Clippings Converter, and in content, I'm going to have a few suggestions on how you can use your Kindle credit. Well, I was up at 5 a.m. this morning here in Denver, my way to the gym for an aerobics workout, when I took a quick peek at my email inbox. The timestamp said 1:50 a.m. on a message that I received from Linda Hopkins, longtime listener, which meant that she had sent it to me just before 1 a.m. California time. That's when she happened to spot a Good News logo superimposed on the image of the boy reading under the Kindle tree at Amazon.com, and it said, "You have a new credit to spend on Kindle books." So I followed this tip from Linda and navigated to the Kindle Books section at Amazon.com, and I saw the same message, and when I clicked on Learn More, I came to a page titled Information for Ebooks Antitrust Settlement. This terse message summarized the facts of the case that we've been following for more than a year, initiated by the Department of Justice against Apple and publishers Hachette, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan & Penguin. And then in surprisingly small print on the website came the news that I've been waiting for. My total credit, $43.36. Darlene was still asleep, so I checked her MacBook Air in the dining room to find out that, not surprisingly, her credit dwarfed mine, coming in at $167.04. She reads a lot more books than I do, and she shares them with friends and family on her Amazon account, so they pitch in, and it's kind of a group buying. But mainly she's buying them. She reads a lot of books. And I think sharing her books is good karma, and here comes some more with this credit that she received. I posted a news alert on the credits to thekindlechronicles.com, and I sent off an email to the 212 of you who are registered for free Kindle Chronicles email updates. By the time my MailChimp notice went out, I think it was arriving in some cases just before Amazon's email to individual customers detailing the amount of your credits in a personal message. This was all unfolding, I think, around 5:30 a.m. Mountain Time, daylight time, and I was also watching on Twitter, where the early risers were happily tweeting the amounts of their Kindle credits, ranging from under a dollar to much higher. And the tweets are mainly pretty giddy enjoyment of the news. Elora Nicole of Austin, Texas, for example, tweeted, "Happiness is waking up to Kindle credit because of the ebook settlement." And Kathy Burris, a.k.a. Princess Kathy on Twitter, wrote, "Well, my Kindle credit wasn't the highest I've seen, but not the lowest either. $5.13 got me a few mini books I didn't know I wanted to read." Enterprising authors were suggesting that customers use the credits to buy their books, and other Twitter users were asking for recommendations. The book credits that began being distributed today are part of a $166 million settlement fund that resulted when the publishers settled with the plaintiffs. These are the state's attorneys general that participated. They didn't admit guilt in the ebook price fixing charges, but they thought that if it went to trial, I'm assuming, and I think the legal analysis shows, they thought they stood to lose a lot more than that $166 million in the settlement. You are eligible for a credit if you purchased one or more ebooks between April 1st, 2010 through May 21st, 2012 that were published by any of those five publishers. You probably remember Random House didn't get caught in this conspiracy initiated by Apple, so Random House books aren't involved in this at all. Laura Hazard-Owen, writing at GigaOhm, reported that the book credits amount to $3.17 for every New York Times bestseller that you purchased during that period, and 73 cents per book for titles not on the bestseller list. A separate deal was negotiated for Minnesota residents. It appears they did a little better because of it, because they received $3.93 per bestseller and 94 cents for non-bestsellers. For most of today, you might have thought Amazon was the only one distributing the book credits. We Kindle ebook purchasers received clear email notification early this morning with the actual amounts of our credits specified. I checked my Barnes & Noble online account this morning, and I didn't even find a mention of this settlement. And then finally, at 2.03 p.m. Denver time, I received a Dear Len Edgerly email from BNN saying that they were happy to let me know I was about to receive my portion of the ebook settlement as an electronic credit. But there was no information in that email about the amount of my credit. A click here link in the email said I have received a credit, but again, there was no mention of how big it was. Another click took me to an FAQ and offered generic information about the credit. And then another link promised, quote, to review your credit detail and eligible ebook purchases, click here. That led to a page titled Ebook Settlement Title Lookup and two fields where I was supposed to enter my settlement ID and zip code. Well, I have no idea what my settlement ID is. Amazon didn't ask for that, and I probably didn't buy enough Nook books between 2010 and 2012 to make the effort to find out the size of my BNN credit even worth the effort. I think this is kind of a classic example of Amazon's frictionless customer interface compared with the formerly number two ebook competitor, which apparently they've slipped to number three behind Apple from something I read today. And when you see the Barnes & Noble web designers and programmers stumbling around the details of this admittedly complicated settlement, I think it gives you a chance to appreciate how much work goes into the drop-dead simple way that Amazon let its customers know about the book credits. These credits expire in a year, by the way, so don't delay in using them to buy your books. And you can also buy print books with them. It doesn't have to be ebooks, but you won't be able to use it to buy episodes of Justified or boxes of paper towels. So this afternoon, Darlene and I were enjoying another sunny afternoon here at our favorite coffee shop in Denver's Lodo District, The Market, on Larimer Street. And as usual, we were sitting there. The Yorkie Claire was with us, sitting on Darlene's lap, and we were reading our Kindle Paperwhites, just having a great time. There were a group of people sitting nearby at a sidewalk table right next to us, and after about 20 minutes, the woman in the group looked at us, and she as if she had been waiting to ask a question, and she finally said, "Have you received your Kindle credit yet?" We grinned and said, "Yes, indeed," and we told her how much our credits had been, and as we talked about it, it was pretty clear that she was somehow involved in this lawsuit, so when I asked her, she said, "Yep, sure enough, she was with the Colorado Attorney General's office." So naturally, I asked if she'd be willing to do a quick interview for the podcast, and she surprised me by saying yes. If she had been one of the attorneys working on the case, I think she would have declined, but as it happened, her job is to provide public information, so she was authorized and very competent to discuss the case. Here's the conversation that we had at The Market this afternoon. This is on Tuesday the 25th, as captured by my iPhone 5S.
My name's Carolyn Tyler, and I'm the Communications Director for the Colorado Attorney General's Office.
And Colorado is one of the lead states in the lawsuit against the publishers?
That's correct. There were 33 states total that ultimately brought suit against the publishing companies. Colorado was one of the lead states that began the enforcement action that led to today's announcement about the settlement.
Now, what's the status of the suit against Apple?
Later this year, the suit against Apple will be settled by a court. Apple has already been found guilty of illegally price-fixing the market and playing a pivotal role in the overall fraud. So They chose not to settle like the other five publishing companies did, so that case will go forward for settlement later this year.
Now, will Judge Coate be the one that decides what kind of damages to award?
It's still, I believe, in the Southern District Court of New York, so yes, I believe it is still Judge Coate, but don't hold me to the actual judge.
Okay. Now, I had some questions from listeners. Apparently, this only benefits customers in the U.S., right, not overseas?
Correct. It was a United States action that was brought by state attorneys general.
And is there similar action being taken by the EU that might benefit customers in the U.K. and Europe?
I'm not as familiar with the European element. I know they were, I believe, taking a look at it.
Right. Now, did you get a refund on some Kindle purchases that you made?
I did not. I actually am still a ye old-fashioned paper book reader myself, but it's delightful to see that you and your lovely companion here are enjoying your e-books and benefiting from today's consumer action. Yeah, so
yeah, we're very grateful.
We're proud
to be from Colorado, understanding that you were one of the leads.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have a wonderful staff in the Attorney General's Consumer Protection section who work very hard.
Well, that was a fun coincidence to run into somebody who had worked on the case, and I'll have a link to the Colorado Attorney General's site, which also has a release that I suspect was prepared by the woman we talked with, Carolyn Tyler, so appreciate her talking with us. This was a good day for ebook lovers, and we may see an even better one later this year if Apple continues its losing ways in the courts, fighting the Department of Justice lawsuit every inch of the way. The current damages being sought from Apple by the attorneys general stands at $840 million, or five times the size of the settlement pool that began flowing to us today. I have no idea what the chances are of that amount of money being paid to ebook purchasers, but I think it seems unlikely that Apple is ever going to settle, and everything I've read makes me think that they face very long odds of success in the appeals process. So there could be an even more rewarding announcement from Amazon later this year when that the potential of funds flowing from Apple is decided. In Darlene's case, an Apple payment five times greater than her windfall today, let's just say it would help her buy enough new Kindle books to last her at least a couple of months. I'd love to hear from you about today's big news event, what you think of it, how you plan to spend your book credits. You can leave a comment at thekindlechronicles.com or email me at podchronicles@gmail.com. And if you haven't yet signed up for the free Kindle Chronicles news alerts, this might be a good day to fill in your name and email at thekindlechronicles.com. You'll see a place to do that on the right side of that page. I let everyone on this list know the moment the week's episode is available for listening, and I also add newsworthy alerts from time to time, like the one today, which I hope will interest you. It's easy to unsubscribe from the list anytime you like if you find it's not meeting your needs, and I'd love to have a lot more of you. I know there are a lot more listening to the podcast than are on that list, and I'd like to build that up as an alternate way to communicate with you. For the tech tip this week, I revisited a free web tool named Clippings Converter. I mentioned this tool available at clippingsconverter.com back in March of 2012 on TKC 188, but since then I really haven't used it regularly. Listener Mike Reeves McMillan reminded me of Clippings Converter in a comment that he left in response to last month's interview with Karina Koch-McLeod of Beyond Paper Editing. Mike said that he, like Karina and her partner Carla Douglas, uses the Kindle for editing his own books rather than printing them out. He added, "I also often beta read for fellow indie authors, and I use the tool at clippingsconverter.com to turn the contents of my Kindle My Clippings file into a spreadsheet or Word document that I can annotate. Works really well." It looks to me as if Clippings Converter has maybe been updated quite a bit since I last tried it. It's now a fairly robust tool for importing your annotations from an e-ink Kindle into the Clippings Converter system and then exporting to a variety of destinations and formats. You decide which parts of the My Clippings information you want to gather. For example, you can leave off the citation of where in the book your highlighter note came from, or you can include the citation. And you can even choose from four different styles of citations by various style manuals and conventions. To be frank, today as I was trying to spend some time at Clippings Converter, I didn't find it that intuitive or simple to learn. There's a lot of information there, and I think it could be kind of simplified in the presentation. But after banging away at it for an hour or more, I did seem to get the hang of it. And the one use case that I've always wished there was a tool like this that really was handy is capturing my annotations in an easy to read document that would be useful for doing book reviews. I wish I was doing more book reviews on Goodreads and different places, and to have all of my annotations would really make that easier. Another use is I have a Bennington MFA friend of mine, Betsy Johnson Miller, who sends me manuscripts and I comment on them, and I could really use an easier way to send her my comments. So I experimented with the various export options from Clippings Converter today. The one that I like best puts it into a Word format, and that just seemed more readable to me because the annotations are separated with double spacing, and if I have a note, it shows up in italics. When I exported to send to Kindle, those separations and font distinctions weren't in the document, so it just seemed a little less convenient to read. The beauty of this tool is that it looks for all your annotations in the My Clippings text file on your e-ink Kindle, and it puts them together by book. Otherwise, your annotations are scattered all through that file depending on when they are entered on your Kindle. If you're switching from book to book, the annotations get sort of mixed up instead of all by book. Now, the one big drawback to this tool is that you have to read the entire book on one device, and it has to be an e-ink Kindle. It doesn't work on the Fire, and that is a problem for the way I read because I like to read books during the day indoors on my Kindle Fire HDX 7-inch and then switch to my Paperwhite in bed or when Darlene and I are reading outdoors at a coffee shop or in Maine at the beach. So I'm not sure it would really be worth the benefits of Clippings Converter to limit my reading of a long book just to my Paperwhite so that I could use this tool. But I think for shorter works, it's certainly an option worth considering. One thing I was pleased to see when I revisited Clippings Converter that they were bragging about a mention the time that I talked about them on the Kindle Chronicles on their homepage at the bottom of the page, along with mentions in Evernote for Dummies and Make Use Of. I think it would have been even better if they had linked to the episode that contained that mention, so maybe they'll have a chance to update their link and they can link to today's mention since we've talked about it again. It's a very robust tool, and a lot of work went into it, and I really like seeing something like this that gives some options for how we use our Kindles in ways that can be very useful. Austin Kleon, who describes himself as a writer who draws, was, as I have mentioned a couple of times in past shows, really the highlight of my experience at South by Southwest. So I was really happy to hear back from him last week as he was about to set off on a grueling book tour to say that he'd be able to do the interview. He did an hour-long interview before South by Southwest that I found on the internet for the frequently explicit and always informative self-publishing podcast. In my shorter conversation with him, if that whets your appetite, of course the best thing to do is to buy his latest book and the one before that, Steal Like an Artist. His first book of the three that he's published in the past 4 years was a collection of poems that he created by blacking out words in newspapers, and that's also worth checking out to see where his ideas about creativity and art kind of got their start in his own work. Austin Kleon notes that Austin was a family name before Texas was a state, and Kleon is Romanian. He was born on June 16, 1983 in Circleville, Ohio, which makes him 30 years old, with a very promising career ahead of him based on the swath that he has cut so far. His work has been translated into more than a dozen languages and featured on NPR's Morning Edition, PBS NewsHour, and in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. The Atlantic magazine called him, quote, positively one of the most interesting people on the internet. In previous lives, he was a librarian, a web designer, and an advertising copywriter. In our Skype conversation, I began by asking Austin which of the 10 chapters in Show Your Work, which detail 10 ways to share your creativity and get discovered, had generated more reaction during his first book tour appearances than he expected, and which ones had generated less than he expected.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think probably the most understood right, or the most misunderstood right up front is chapter 9, Sell Out, which was, you know, kind of intended to be provocative. You know, we think of selling out as a very bad thing. And so I wanted that chapter to kind of push people to think about art and money and creativity and money in a different way. And so, you know, the funny thing about these books is they're kind of a grab bag of ideas. You know, there's definitely a string that ties everything together, but everything kind of stands on its own too, you know? So it's been interesting to watch people react to the sellout chapter.
What do people misunderstand about it, do you think?
Oh, I think the misunderstanding is right up front is that I'm, you know, trying to say, oh, sell out, you know, like,
yeah.
So one of my friends made the joke recently, said, you know, oh, your integrity is like your virginity. You should get rid of it as early as possible. So it's not that at all. You know, I mean, the sellout chapter is really about kind of getting over that whole notion of selling out in the first place and kind of rethinking what the relationship between art and commerce is in the first place, and kind of understanding that, you know, some of our favorite art was made for money, and that there's not anything wrong with making money, but more importantly, that there's not anything wrong with ambition, that there's not anything wrong with, like, kind of taking your game up a level and trying to give yourself ways to kind of keep going, you know. And so that's what I was trying to attempt in that chapter, but that doesn't really come up, you know. That it's funny, the question of money comes up a lot. You know, oh, that's great, well, how do we make money off this? And one of the things I always tell people is, like, well, you know, you're not guaranteed a living from this. I think what you're guaranteed is a life. You know, you can set up a life through this way of operating. But I do think that, you know, if you operate this way, you know, you have a better shot at a living, right? Mm. So yeah, as far as the thing that's been the most popular, I think Brian Eno's idea of senius has been the thing that's been really sticky for people.
And can you describe that? I heard you talk about it South by Southwest, but what's the idea there?
Yeah, so Brian Eno's idea of senius is a direct response to our idea of the lone genius as art and culture coming primarily from individuals who are kind of superhumanly talented. Brian Eno's idea is one of senius, which is a kind of communal genius, the idea that ideas and culture and great things rise up out of a whole network of people. And I think that idea has resonated. I mean, that idea kind of lays the foundation for the book, because once you start thinking in terms of senius, your whole way of operating kind of switches, and you start thinking differently about what it is that you do. And so, you know, it's always funny when you put out a book and the idea that sticks with people isn't your own. But that kind of goes along with my work, actually. It's kind of a perfect example.
Exactly. You talked after your last tour that the publisher sends the author out for one purpose, and that's to sell books, and you can sometimes lose sight of that. But have you adjusted your book-selling tools and methods this tour in any way that looks like it's paying off so far?
You know, one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm trying not to become a piece of human spam. And what I mean by that is, in the book, I kind of talk about, you know, it's very easy to just become this endless promotional machine, you know, and you're just, like, constantly spewing out your own stuff, and you're not really taking things in, and you're not listening, and you just, like, get sick of the sound of your own voice, you know. So one of the things I'm trying to do is, you know, I've been blessed by, like, landing in these kind of wonderful bookstores on tour, and there are so many great independent bookstores left that have these amazingly curated collections and these wonderful people inside. And so the way I've tried to start all my book tour events is I show up at the I show up at the store and I immediately start shopping. You know, I start making my way to all the different sections. And what I do is I pull off books that I'm either interested in or that I have been old favorites of mine, you know. And then what I try to do is, like, towards the end of the talk, I try to weave those books into, you know, part of my talk. And that, you know, part of the idea of the book is that if you want to have fans, you have to be a fan first. And if you want to have an audience, you have to be an audience first. And so I try to always, you know, kind of point my attention outwards towards things that I love and, you know, try to give people a little reading list. So I've been doing that at events. I've been pulling like 5 books off the shelves and sharing them with the audience. And then I've been taking a shot for Instagram and posting it online. And I'm hoping, you know, this is a 20-city tour, so I'm hoping to have something, you know, I have to do that math real quick, you know, something like 100 books in a gallery at the end of the tour that I can then share with everybody.
And you're actually buying the books and bringing them home with you.
Well, no. I mean, a lot of them are books I already have.
Oh,
and
I see.
Frankly, I can't fit that many books in my suitcase.
Oh, okay. So you're highlighting them.
When you're doing, you know, when you're doing 3 or 4 nights a week, if you bought 5 books at each store, you'd have to ship them all out. But
exactly.
You know, what I'm doing is I'm pointing to them and saying, hey, this is a great book. And hopefully the idea isn't that I buy them, it's that someone in the audience buys them.
Sure, yeah. Well, now, of course, my audience is interested in the Kindle and e-books. And I'm curious, in readings at independent bookstores, do people in the audience who read most of their books on Kindle and probably bought your books on Kindle or another e-book reader keep that to themselves, or does the topic of somebody buying your book on their iPhone as they sit there listening to you come up? Or what do you hear about ebooks at these events?
I don't hear a lot about ebooks at these events. Sometimes people will come up and say, oh, I've read your book on ebook. But a lot of times what they'll do is they'll just buy another copy. I mean, my books are so low priced that it's really not much pocket change to go ahead and shell out for the paper book. And it is a superior experience in paper. I mean, you know, the ebook is great and we, you know, it reads well. And I know there are the numbers are staggering to me, how many people are buying ebooks versus paper for this newest book.
Really? Is it at least half, or what do you think it is?
Let's see. Let me think about this. It's not quite half, but it's basically for every, I think one week it was for every 7 books we sold in paper, there were 5 in ebook.
Wow.
That's pretty staggering, you know, especially for an illustrated book that's, you know, that's beautifully produced and very cheap, you know. It's interesting how many people still want to read it on their e-readers.
Yeah.
I think one thing about ebooks is that, you know, it's still pretty hard to gift an ebook. You know, there's people still want that tangible, you know, that tangible thing they can hand to someone else. So I think a lot of times people say, oh, I read your book on Kindle, or I read your book on, you know, my iPad, but I want to get a copy for my daughter, or, you know, I want to get a copy for my cousin who's starting a business, you know, that kind of thing.
I think in some ways your books, you've said that they end up in the self-help area, but also at the cash register sort of as gifts. Because of that, I mean, I wanted to get my wife a copy of your 2 books, and she's a big Kindle reader, so I was thinking, well, I'll just gift it to her by email. It's a really nice process they set up. But I ended up buying physical copies of it, and it's going to be here by tomorrow in time for her birthday.
Cool.
But I think it probably wasn't your plan, but your books tend up, I would think, do pretty well in both media.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my audience is a very digitally savvy one. And so a lot of people, you know, it's been interesting finding out why people want the ebook. Like, a lot of people travel and they want it as a reference. Like, I never realized how much people would use my books as a reference book. And so they, you know, they keep it on their device so they can kind of always access it. That's interesting. But the cash register thing, I mean, that's also, it is in a genre of gift book, you know, and we did know that when we were pitching the book, that it was going to be that kind of, they call them impulse buys. I was actually just in DC and they're selling it by the cash register in the National Portrait Gallery. which was incredible. And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that the only, I think they're kind of exist, you know, my books kind of exist in this analog digital. I mean, it's interesting because so much of my books start in an analog fashion. You know, they start with handwriting, they start with drawings, they start with, you know, poems I've made with a newspaper and a marker. And then they're always, you know, they're converted to digital. I mean, everything goes into the computer and I lay everything out, yeah. You know. And then they go back to paper again and digital, you know, so there's just this whole like analog digital loop. And now what's interesting is that a few of my readers, I've noticed they like to highlight or underline the analog, you know, the paper version of the book, but then they'll post it on Instagram or, you know, on their blog or whatever. And so it becomes digitized again. And so I think I have this kind of like, I have this whole like, you know, kind of hybrid analog digital thing, you know, and I think that's the way that that's comfortable for me. I'm totally fine with that. I think there's room for, you know, there's room for everything. I will say that I'm personally biased towards, you know, the experience of holding a book in the hand and flipping the pages, but that's also, you know, I read a lot of books on ebook too. I mean, I happen to be doing books that are designed explicitly for print.
Yeah.
You know, but that will increasingly change. Like even on this book, we were, you know, thinking about how it was going to translate to digital and to ebook. Luckily, the illustrations aren't incredibly detailed. So I think they, you know, they're very quick and very simple illustrations. So I think they, translate pretty well.
Yeah, and they look good even on the e-ink readers.
Yeah, I mean, it's black and white, so I mean, it looks cool. It's interesting. My first book just came out in e-book, my first book, Newspaper Blackout. And it's been interesting. When we put that book out in 2010, I mean, we didn't even bother thinking about an e-book version because we were just like, nothing can handle this. It'll look like crap. And now it's interesting. I think, you know, I've seen a few. It looks great on the iPad. It looks unbelievable on the iPad. I don't know if it was you or someone else posted a picture of it on the Kindle Paperwhite.
Yeah,
and it looks pretty good too. Yeah. So, it's interesting to see what the technology, what's happening, and you know what the possibilities are.
Yeah, I read the Paperwhite when I'm outside or in bed, but I use the Kindle Fire for all my other reading. And, and I was reading, I think it was probably the first book, Steal Like an Artist, and you mentioned an interview in the Paris Review with William Burroughs. And and I sort of knew this, but it just was because of what you were saying, I highlighted William Burroughs' interview, Paris Review, from your book, and then I tapped more on my Kindle Fire. And then I tapped on the little web search. So within two taps, I was looking at the interview that you had mentioned. And it sort of sent a chill up my spine. I said, you know, we now are able to travel these paths that you lay out in this idea that of the Senius in an amazingly fluid way because of this technology.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be really exciting for authors. I mean, I was just talking to Tom Standage online. He did a book called Writing on the Wall, a kind of 2,000-year history of social media. And what he was saying was he put like the first chapter or something of his book up on Rap Genius, which is a website that people use to annotate song lyrics.
Right.
But what he was saying is like, oh, you can put your, you know, you put your chapter up there. And then you can either annotate it yourself or people can annotate it, you know, with their own material. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's just really, that's really fascinating, that idea of being able to kind of build this hypertextual document that links from all over. Now, I will say on the flip side of that, to be devil's advocate, I think one of the things that can also be extremely distracting to people. I mean, I know people who hate Kindle highlights. They hate being able to see what other people have highlighted. And there's something beautiful about that nonlinear experience of being taken through a story or a narrative and not being distracted. I mean, I know, like, especially with like memoir and fiction, you know, I tend to use the ebook more for that stuff just because I find it very easy to page through. And not, you know, just like keep giving me the story. And nonfiction, on the other hand, I like to read a lot of nonfiction on paper because I like to make notes to myself. I like to set it down and go look something up and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's interesting to think about your own reading habits and then discover the habits of others. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. You link to an interview with Mike Watt of the Minutemen, and there was an interesting concept there. He was quoting D. Boone and saying that anything that's not the gig is a flyer. In other words, if the flyer is everything that pointed people to the gig. But when I actually listened to the interview, it seemed like he had shifted his point of view, because the gig in those days was this incredibly immediate experience, connecting without any filters with the audience.
Right.
And they thought that was what they wanted to drive everything toward. But now, 30 years later, he's realizing that the records they made, they're like his children that will outlast him.
Right.
And so, you know, the thing that's not the flyer, I think, has shifted in his mind. But when I think about all of the ways that you're connecting with people, you know, the book and the events and the blog, and what's the gig now, and what are the flyers for you?
Well, I almost wonder if the metaphor is broken. I mean, I almost wonder if it's even a good metaphor, because, I mean, it's true. It's like, in some cases now, I'm not real sure what's the flyer or what's the gig. Because, for example, like, in some ways, I would almost think that Twitter is a flyer, right? Well, Twitter, you use it to get people places, to see new things, you know, to push new stuff. But on the other hand, is Twitter the gig? Because Twitter is its own experience, and it's its own place where you hang out. And, you know, you take like your Instagram account or something. Is that a gig or a flyer? You know, it's almost like, is the gig and flyer metaphor, does it even work anymore? You know, but I'm not sure about that. And frankly, I'm not really sure what outlet. I never know if my books are my books advertising my art? Are they advertising my talks? Or are the books the products themselves? I mean, they're gigs and flyers at the same time. You know, it's weird. So that's a really interesting question. Maybe it changes, you know. But I've just always found the Minutemen to be, I think, that particular era of punk rock and kind of underground rock, to me, is very instructive to our current era, because these guys were doing all the things we think of as, you know, grassroots building and networking and all that stuff. They're doing it without the internet.
Yeah.
And so a band like the Minutemen, you know, in the 80s, trying to get their scene together and build their lists and tour and build networks. I mean, to think about the fact that they did that without the internet is really amazing to me. Yeah. You know, and I think about all the bands today that whine about how they can't make a living. And if you just go back 20 years, you know, or more than that, you know, these guys were carving out their own thing too. And, you know, the whole idea of, particularly with the Minutemen, I mean, the whole idea of jamming econo, so to speak, of keeping things lean and keeping your operation really minimal and, you know, keeping your day job and, you know, doing your art on the side. I just think they're really an inspirational band to get to know and learn about. Plus, their music kicks ass. You know? But no, that's interesting. I mean, maybe there aren't gigs and flyers anymore. Maybe it's all just one big gig.
Yeah.
You know?
It's
a great question.
Huh. Well, last question. It sounded like you were thinking about another sabbatical, like the time you had when you got out of college and you had a library job. And I wondered if so far in this tour you're feeling more drawn to a sabbatical or less drawn to a sabbatical, and what would be the perfect place for you to do a sabbatical now if you were able to put it together?
Gosh, I think a good sabbatical for me would be a staycation. You know, I would just really like to be at home and play with my son and see my wife and just spend a lot of time out in the garage making stuff. You know, I think probably what would look like a sabbatical to me would look like a bunch of work to other people. You know, I mean, like, one of the things, you know, you want to talk about gigs versus flyers. I mean, I feel like right now I'm all flyer. You know, it's all promotion. It's all talking. It's all, you know, spreading the word about the book. And I'm really itching to get that. You know, I've put out 3 books in 4 years, and it's really just I'm getting to a point now where, you know, it's really – I'm really ready to have that kind of playtime. You know, I'm ready to the metaphor I like to use is that at one point, Apple Computer, I think they were making half their revenue or most of their revenue off of products that didn't exist 3 years ago. And so I'm always, you know, I'm always wary of spending all your time promoting what's already out there. Because you have to be, you know, R&Ding, you know, you have to be like developing the thing that's going to be your next thing, you know. But it's very difficult. It's particularly difficult for someone like me, who does a lot of their own promotion and marketing and stuff, to not just, you almost have to let that period pass before you can get into the next thing. I mean, I told myself with this book I wasn't going to let myself slip off track and not work. But it's been very difficult. So I think what a sabbatical looks like for me is just staying home and working a lot, but work with the capital W, you know, the important work.
I've been speaking with Austin Kleon, author of Show Your Work, Steal Like an Artist, and Newspaper Blackout, all 3 of which are available now as ebooks. Thanks very much, Austin.
Thank you, Len.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, you too. Those were really great. Thank you for the really great questions. I'm glad we can make this happen.
In content, I heard from listener John Aga, who had a recommendation for using Kindle Credit, which I have filed away. It looks very promising. He said, if you have an interest in history, I most highly recommend the World War II trilogy from author Rick Atkinson. They are The Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943. That's Volume 1. And then Volume 2 is The Day of Battle, The War in Sicily and Italy. That covers 43-44. And the third is The Gun's Last Light, The War in Western Europe from 44-45. John says that the author's first book in that trilogy earned him a Pulitzer Prize for history. So he says, I urge you to check it out, and I'll pass that along. I looked at the first part of the first volume, and it's beautifully written. The 3 of them together cost $36.99, which would just about wipe out my Kindle credit, so I didn't do it right away, but I filed it away for on my wish list. And it also looked like if you buy the books individually, it would cost less than buying them as a trilogy for some reason. Although I can kind of see the benefit of having them all together. I think that'd be kind of handy. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be James McQuivey, whom I interviewed yesterday as soon as I finished talking with Austin Kleon. James, who works at Forrester Research, has been a frequent guest on the show, was, as usual, full of sage perspective on what's happening in digital media, especially in ebooks, and things Amazon might do to maintain its advantage. As I said at the opening, Darlene and I are about to head off to Cambridge, Massachusetts for a week, and then on April 10th, we're scheduled to join our Casper friends Tom and Tish for a riverboat cruise down the Rhine River from Basel, Switzerland to Amsterdam, and then we'll part ways, and Darlene and I will finish the trip with 3 days in Paris. After a personal highlight for me who loves trains, we're going to take a fast train from Amsterdam to Paris, which should be really a delight. Now, of course, I'll be taking my tech arsenal, including Google Glass, for the trip, and I want to put together a Google Plus circle of friends and family who might be interested in seeing Glass videos and photos from the trip. It's remarkably easy to shoot video while wearing Glass, and if there's Wi-Fi, I can upload it to my Google account in minutes. I'm calling this circle, which at this point only has Darlene in it, my TKC Eurocam circle. And if you'd like to be included in it, I think you just email me your Google Plus profile page or how I can find it to podchronicles@gmail.com. And then you would need to put me in a circle, otherwise you wouldn't see my updates to the circle as it goes along. Now, this is kind of an experiment, and if you are a Google Plus ninja who can help me think through the details of doing this. I think it'd be fun to, I can imagine being on the boat and putting glass on and showing you some quick videos. And then also you can even do a Google Plus Hangout, so you'd have a bird's eye view on some of the sites that we're going to be seeing on this trip, which I'm really looking forward to. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ramonk by Yval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD. That's by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly recording in downtown Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.